The Guardian.
Hey, it's Lee Alexander, and before you get started with this podcast, we want to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For everything you need to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian to get 10% off your first purchase. And now on with the show. Again, it's me, Lee Alexander, from The Guardian's Chips with Everything podcast, and today we have a very special episode to share with you. We've teamed up with our very own Science Weekly podcast, so with me today in the studio is the head of science for The Guardian, the one and only Ian Sample.
Thanks, Lee. It's really good to be on here. We should have done this many, many months ago. Today's topic is ripe for a collaboration. We're going to look at big data, algorithms, and what on earth they mean for our lives.
A computer is an educational device. It is in fact a direct reflection of your own imagination, your own intelligence, your own programming skills.
They think that these are neutral. They think that because it's a computer chip, it doesn't care who I am. But the irony is, because it's a computer chip, its prejudices have been embedded in its programming. It's more prejudiced and more biased than even a human would be.
I think a lot of these algorithms are failures because they are failures of imagination. They're trying to sort of very, very locally, incrementally improve a situation rather than looking at the overall question that's being asked.
So you ate the pod, like you had to depod like them?
Before we delve into it all, a couple of definitions perhaps, okay. Because this can all get a little bit complicated.
Like, was it wasabi peas?
This is Cathy O'Neill, mathematician and author of Weapons of Math Destruction.
Sugar,
I started by asking her what big data is.
Okay, well, there's actually two ways of thinking about this. And the first one is an unnecessary technical way that we don't care about, but I'll tell you anyway. It's like big data is essentially a moving target. It's casually described as like if it's too big to fit on your computer, then it's big data. It used to be like if it's too big to fit on an Excel spreadsheet, but then people like move past Excel spreadsheets and then they were like, okay, I want to do it on my computer. Oh no, I can't anymore. That's big. I have to use the Amazon cloud to do this kind of computation. But it's actually not the point for my book. For my book, big data is much more of a way of thinking about predicting the future, which assumes that more data is better. And it's predicting and describing people rather than like the stars movement or the markets. So it explicitly has not only a descriptive purpose, but an influential purpose as well. So big data engenders feedback loops, if you will. So the Facebook algorithm, it tells you what your friends are interested in, but it also affects what you see in the environment you're in. So it has this kind of feedback loop where it actually changes what we're interested in as well as describing what we're interested in.
You start the book talking about models, and can you talk us through what a model is? What are the main types of models
Sure.
you cover?
So a model, I speak pretty loosely because it's not that important to be technically correct. A model is something that is a pattern matching to some kind of definition of success. So if you're going to build a model, and this is sort of the way you should consider it, you need two basic ingredients. One is the historical data from which the model would be trained, the things that will look for historical patterns, and then you need sort of an objective function, a definition of success. So I like to give an example, if you don't mind, of a very basic model, because I just want to make the point that everybody uses models every day. Sometimes they're formalized and put into computer code, but most of the time they're not. So the model I'm thinking about is like the model for cooking dinner for my children. The data that goes into that is the food that I have on hand every day, the amount of time I have, the amount of ambition I have, and then the definition I choose for a successful meal is whether my kids have enough vegetables in their meal, right? So the important point, and there's actually a couple of important points. The first one is that the food I choose to use for my model, the data I even consider relevant, is curated by me. I don't consider ramen noodles to be actually food, so I don't use that as an ingredient, even though my teenage sons would love a dinner with ramen noodles, right? So I'm already curating the data. That's my agenda I'm projecting onto my data. And then I'm also projecting my agenda onto my definition of success, whether my kids ate vegetables. If my son, my seven-year-old, were in charge, then he would define success for me to be if he had a lot of Nutella. And the reason this matters is because over time, we train our models to optimize success. We want to get closer and closer to success on a daily basis or a minute-to-minute basis if you're Amazon.com. Which means that in the future, I am looking for meals that have historically been successful, which means historically my kids ate a lot of vegetables. And that's a very different kind of trajectory of meals at my household than my seven-year-old would have us eat with his definition of success.
So to recap there, what she's essentially saying is that the models themselves are not inherently our enemy. Rather, it's actually all about what data is going into the model and how success is being measured.
Exactly.
And that's actually something that Douglas Rushkoff, the author, media critic, original cyberpunk, personal hero of mine.
Hello? Whoa, you got a crazy overmodulating mic there. Let me see.
That's something that we spoke about over Skype a couple of days ago.
It depends what those algorithms are programmed to do. You know, so if we fill the... say we fill the stock market exchanges with algorithms that are designed to beat human traders or extract a few pennies from every trade, and it amounts to a tax on humans. So then the stock market is no longer simply, you know, deploying capital to the entrepreneurs and companies that need it, but the entire stock market slowly but surely becomes, you know, yet another way of financializing business, of figuring out ways to take money from those who need to transact. And when you, you know, when you do it with a few specialists, a few firms looking to make a buck here and there, it's one thing. But when you reconfigure the entire marketplace for that, you end up with a stock market that's no longer serving its original function. It ends up really just taking money out of the business cycle rather than putting it into businesses.
And I mean, you only have to look as far as the 2008 financial crash to realize the dangers of this.
Funny you should say that, because Kathy, having been a professor of mathematics, learned all about these pitfalls firsthand when she worked in the financial sector in 2007. And it was here that she saw what she calls the weaponization of mathematics.
And I left finance in large part because I did not want to be part of that. I wanted to be part of something where mathematics was used to help people, or at least it was morally neutral. So I found myself as a data scientist very soon after I left finance. It's actually not that much of a different kind of job, actually, being a quant in finance or a data scientist. I found myself doing stuff with ad tech, where I was basically modeling people instead of markets, which is typical in data science. That's what data scientists do. They predict people. And I was doing what everybody does in ad tech on the web, which is to say I was segmenting people.
She was choosing some people to show ads to and some people to not show ads to, grouping them into what she called marketing silos. And so in a small way, she was presenting opportunities to some people while not presenting those same opportunities to other people.
We're told that we're being given opportunities, and to a large extent, we are being given opportunities. I am being given opportunities to buy luxury yarn because I'm a huge knitter and I'm very vulnerable to yarn advertisements. At the other end, like people, yeah, there's these extremely predatory for-profit colleges. There are quite a few of them that have gotten in trouble recently for outright fraudulent marketing, where they promise a better life. They first find your cone of pain, and they specifically target single mothers of color who are poor enough to qualify for federal aid. So they're only interested in people that are poor enough to be eligible for this federal aid and who are low information enough to be vulnerable to their come-ons. I mean, I interviewed a bunch of college preparedness advisors in the New York City area whose students are vulnerable to these ads. And here's what's going on. Their parents are first-generation immigrants who have been told and understand and believe that their children need to go to college in order to be middle-class citizens. And that's an absolutely true fact. The problem is that they don't actually know the difference between a private college and a for-profit college. They know that private's better than public, so they often have this bizarre understanding of the system to think that, oh, you don't want to go to City University of New York or City College, which are totally great schools. You should go instead to the University of Phoenix. They actually, that makes logical sense to them because they don't have enough information. The technology that we've created to give me yarn advertisements is perfectly suited to find those people.
So instead of the system serving us as people, in reality, they're actually serving the profit-driven companies who program them.
We're building algorithms really for one purpose and one purpose alone, and that is for the, you know, the short-term extractive capacity of the company that's writing the algorithm. You know, that's the only thing it's about. So the algorithm on Facebook or Google that return your search results or composes your newsfeed, that algorithm's not thinking, you know, how can we serve this user? The algorithm is there to figure out how can we get this user to buy more stuff or click on more things. And to do that, you know, the simplest path for these algorithms is to try to make you more you, or make you into the ultimate consumer version of yourself. So yeah, you end up with algorithms that reinforce your biases, your sort of thought and consumption tunnels as best they can.
So here's a really spooky example in my life. I got engaged last year and I sent a single GChat message to my best friend to tell her. Immediately, wedding ads began proliferating all over my Facebook page. And I found it, you know, quite unsettling that Facebook knew that I was getting married before many of my friends and family even did.
How did that make you feel then?
You know, it's interesting because theoretically, you know, I should have wanted to see some wedding bargains, you know, but instead I just kind of felt unsettled and violated. The real issue here is that they're trying to service us based on a computer profile that only has to do with what we do online, and it doesn't know anything about what we do offline.
I like what Douglas was saying about this perfect consumer version of your own self, and it's made me worry that an app or a message might come up on your phone saying, there's a great pizza place around the corner. And as these algorithms do get better and better, that we may start just relying on them and trusting them so much that we think, actually, I'm not quite sure what I'll do. My phone probably knows what thousands of other Ians at this time of day, when they've had this kind of day, you know, before. I will start trusting it so much that it will actually start leading my life for me in some ways.
Well, that's exactly what these advertisers would like. They would love to see you become a predictable consumer.
And this is what I worry about, that we don't actually need to be predicted anymore because we're so trusting of our algorithms that we just go along with what they say. It's just, we just become drones. And it's not just the worlds of finance, tech, and advertising that are using and abusing these kinds of systems. After this short break, we'll hear how the criminal justice system in America is using algorithms to predict criminal activity.
Absolutely, it's happening in many states. It's actually being pushed at this point in a bipartisan way, partly because everybody thinks it's objective and fair, as a way of possibly solving the mass incarceration problem that we now face.
Hi, it's Jason Phipps here, ruler of all things podcast here at The Guardian. Just to let you know that this episode is sponsored by the good people at Squarespace. To find out more about how to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
Hello, it's Susanna Tresillian. I'm an audio producer at The Guardian. If you like this show, you should also be listening to The Guardian's Books podcast. It's our weekly look at the world of books, poetry, and great writing, with in-depth interviews, book reviews, and so much more.
Welcome back to this special Guardian podcast. Again, I'm Science Weekly's Ian Sample.
And I'm Lee Alexander from Chips with Everything, which is our digital culture podcast.
And before the break, we heard from Cathy O'Neill and Douglas Rushkoff about how big data and algorithms are being used to influence our everyday lives, and not in a good way.
And nowhere is this more apparent than in America's criminal justice system, where many states have started to use these systems to predict what's known as recidivism risk.
Recidivism risk is the risk that people will go back to prison after leaving prison. Since 97% of prisoners eventually leave, the question is, what's their risk of coming back? It turns out that judges use this kind of consideration, recidivism, in order to sentence people. They've always done that, but nowadays they have sort of like scientific risk scores for each defendant when they're being sentenced. And judges, judges sentence people with high risk, they sentence them to longer in jail.
And as Cathy points out, there are two sources of data that these decisions rely on.
The first is arrest records, essentially. Like what did this person actually get arrested for? The problem with arrest records is that data is biased. So let me just throw out one statistic. Whites and blacks smoke pot at about the same rate in the United States, but blacks are much more likely to be arrested for smoking pot. So it's like, depending on the jurisdiction, by the way, could be twice as likely, three times as likely, up to 10 times as likely. So there's two important things there. First, it's biased against black people. And second, it really depends on the jurisdiction, how much bias it is towards black people, which is to say that arrest records should be seen not as crime records, because after all, most crimes do not result in an arrest, actually, but they should be seen as just as much a reflection of police practices as they are of crimes. So that's kind of the first kind of ingredient that's funneled into the recidivism risk. The second kind of data that goes into this is even more problematic because it, at least in the case I looked at, the most popular recidivism risk algorithm, which is called the LSIR, there's a questionnaire that every defendant has to fill out. And the questions themselves are proxies for race and class. Now, to be clear, there's no question that says, are you black? That would be disallowed, and it never shows up, although it did a few decades ago. They ruled that unconstitutional. So now we don't have that directly. But instead, we have questions like, did you get suspended a lot in high school? Which we actually know is a proxy for race. Like, black kids are much more likely to get suspended than white kids. We also have questions that are very directly proxies of class. Did you grow up in a high crime neighborhood? And given that we already have uneven policing and, you know, uneven biased arrest records, that's also a proxy. And then the one that really drives me nuts, that I think is kind of like proof positive that this stuff is just deeply unfair, is the question, was anybody in your family in trouble with the law? This is a question that in open court, if a lawyer stood up and said, judge, could you please sentence this man to longer in jail because his father was in jail, it would be thrown out. And the overall problem here is that the defendants don't understand their score. The judges don't exactly explain how they're using it, but they tend to use it to sentence people for longer if they have higher risk. And so you have this thing where people are judged not by what they did necessarily, but by where they were born. The point is that it's sort of creating its own reality. It's creating and engendering this very pernicious feedback loop that keeps people in jail.
And that lines up with what Douglas was saying.
Yeah, and I did actually ask Douglas about crime, and he did say that this is, in fact, a discrete way of normalizing racial profiling.
The argument being, you know, it's not me being racist, it's the algorithm.
Exactly. And while the problem is all too clear to see, what is the solution?
It's called understanding the difference between causality and correlation. It's absolutely true that people who are living in high crime neighborhoods are more likely to go to jail. I'm not questioning the accuracy of this. The question is why. And the answers are probably things along the lines of because they're much more scrutinized by the police, because the police pick up people with mental health problems instead of treating them, because people arrest people with addictions instead of treating them, because police arrest people that are poor and are doing things that poor people do, like pee on the street because there's no public bathrooms. So a lot of it is just literally accurate, except it's not crime, really. It's just poverty. And it's a lack of social welfare. So that's one thing. Another thing is one of the reasons they're coming back to prison is because they can't get jobs because of racism and because of the stigma of having been in prison. That's something we need to work on as a society. So in other words, there are all sorts of these real reasons that these recidivism risks are high. But instead of taking them on as social challenges for our community, we have decided to allot blame on the individual and punish them for it by sending them to jail longer, which actually makes things worse.
But how should we push back?
Well, the way we should do it is we should audit the overall justice system. What is working here? What is an intervention we can stage so that the recidivism discrepancy between whites and blacks, between poor and rich, gets smaller? That's something we haven't considered doing. We haven't even done this sort of scientific experiment to say, what improves this discrepancy? How do we get people better situated after they leave prison so that they are less likely to come back to prison?
So you redefine success that the model is assessing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of these algorithms are failures because they are failures of imagination. They're trying to sort of very, very locally, incrementally improve a situation rather than looking at the overall question that's being asked. So the question that's the local situation is here is, you know, who's likely to come back to prison and what should we do about it? And the real question is, what is prison for? And how do we make our society safer?
Yeah, there needs to be some kind of means to correct for inherent social biases in data. I did an article for the Tech Desk not long ago about some researchers who had worked on a sort of means of correcting these systemic biases, specifically in hiring algorithms and specifically as concerns prison records. But there really is no standardization being done, is there?
No, one of the things Kathy raised was that there is no overarching regulatory body that can look at these algorithms and decide whether they're sensible or not. What she did say, though, is we need to have audits of them, and those audits should be reviewed by an independent regulatory body. So she's not calling for total transparency. I don't think that's going to happen. But you can at least have the audits as being transparent, and so you can compare them, you know, with what's going on in the world and seeing if an algorithm is causing problems.
This issue is just upsets me so much. It upsets me when I hear it. And, you know, this has a massive impact on people's lives. And the public has almost no information about how all of this is working. And we have the illusion that this technology is safe because it's new. Supposedly.
And it's not just that the algorithms are opaque, it's that the very existence of the algorithms is opaque. That I don't even know, you don't even know, no one really knows what algorithms are making decisions that are gently nudging and gently sort of altering their lives as they go through every day.
Yeah, of course. We don't know a lot about how is the success of an algorithm measured? How do we know? How can we audit whether its predictions are correct or whether it's, you know, targeting people accurately?
I don't think this is an entirely new story, though. If you look at any new technology like artificial intelligence or even the internet, there are always going to be people who want to use them for their own benefit, regardless of who suffers.
Yeah, maybe it's just the case that we're not using algorithms in the right places.
Imagine what algorithms could do to try to find correspondences between behaviors and cancers and fertility and, I mean, so many questions we have about how to heal ourselves and how to fix things and how to, in health alone, so many answers are there, but inaccessible because of our inability to mine that data for cures, for associations, for ideas.
Oh, I'm actually very optimistic. I really feel like some of these algorithms were just like slapdash thrown together and thrown out there, and people just assume they're working, and they're just not working. That doesn't mean we can't get something that works. I mean, I'm optimistic, because here's the thing. Once we carefully make sure that these algorithms are fair, they will actually be better than the humans that they replace. Judges in the justice system are famously racist, right? So once we have algorithms that like help judges be more fair, and they're actually useful and they're fair themselves, that will be an improvement, right? So there's actually a lot of potential for like living the big data dream. Right now, we're not there. I'm sounding the alarm. Hey, we can't assume that we're doing everything perfectly just because we're using algorithms. But that isn't to say that we can't do better. Can't we do a lot better than what we're doing now?
So I guess it's a case of being less worried about the algorithms themselves and what they're doing, and more so about the people who are programming them and their intentions.
Yeah, eventually perhaps algorithms could actually correct for social biases rather than simply perpetuating them. And it does seem like people are becoming more and more aware of these kinds of things, thanks to the likes of people like Kathy and Douglas. This podcast has been presented by me, Lee Alexander.
And me, Ian Sample. Special thanks this week to Kathy O'Neill.
And to Douglas Rushkoff as well. If you're interested in finding out more about today's topics, head over to the Guardian website and click on the links in the show's description to check out books by both Kathy and Douglas.
The producers were Matt Shaw and Max Sanderson.
Chips with Everything and Science Weekly can both be found on iTunes or on your favorite podcast app, so make sure to subscribe to them both.